Hi, my name is Alan Poole, and this is the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
What is up, sir?
Hey, it's the AI version of Ilya.
Bleep, bleep, blarp. I am Ben Rockbot.
Before we get into all of the latest AI industry stuff, who's on the show today?
It is showrunner Alan Poole, who is kind of a legend and was the showrunner on Tokyo Vice and director, if I'm correct.
He did. He directed several episodes, and so did Joseph Kubota Vladika, who, of course, also another friend of the show. So we have a lot of connections to Tokyo Vice, and it was really a wonderful interview, and we'll get into it in just a moment. But I don't know if you remember.
I have no memory.
Going back a few weeks ago, you basically put out a challenge to all of our listeners to punk us, to take our database of recordings of voices and make a AI version of the Cinematography Podcast. Do you remember this?
I would never have done that. That wasn't me. That was AI.
That was absolutely you. Mm-mm. And it turns out one of our listeners and friend of the show, Andy Lemon, went out and made a AI version of the Cinematography Podcast. And it's about 3 minutes long. And we're going to play it right now.
Are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hello, Ben. How is it going?
Well, Hollywood is at it again.
How so?
Someone wrote another article about the Blair Witch Project and didn't mention my name. That's just bullshit.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
This happens every time. I know it was 20 something years ago, but I just feel that.
Hey, Ben, who is our guest today?
Oh, what? Our guest? It's none other than friend of the show, Charles Papert. I like to call him the Charles.
Yes, the Charles. Let's hear from the Charles.
Hello, Charles. It's nice to see you again.
It's lovely to be here again, although it's been a while.
Yes, episode 11, I believe. That was a long time ago.
I know we've seen a lot since then.
Well, Charles, I hear you are bringing us something new to share.
The internets are saying you have a new camera?
I do have something new for you. I have been in the industry a long time, and as film stock and digital cameras have been developed, the designers have always been trying to make them better. Better color, higher resolution, smaller and lightweight. I feel the time was right for me to weigh in with a camera of my own.
Is this something groundbreaking?
Earth-shattering? Tell us.
I'd like to reveal to you, for the first time, the Brown camera.
The Brown camera?
Yes. The Brown. Instead of getting better, the Brown is getting worse.
Worse? What? Is that what you just took out of that case? What's that smell?
Yes, worse, and here it is. Words I would use to describe the Brown are gritty and organic, with a certain character that is familiar but not pleasing. Now is the right time for the Brown to put things in perspective. I think it will wipe up some of the mess that the industry has made.
This is so nutty. Is this the first camera you've made?
No, actually is number two.
Number two? Let me take a look.
Yes, I like to call it the deuce. Careful, don't drop it.
I think this thing is really going to make a splash when it lands.
What's the color space?
Log, of course, and it's built to be super strong.
I can feel its heavy duty.
It's also water resistant, so you can drop it off at the pool. It's a floater.
Amazing, Charles. I think that's a great place to wrap things up. Thank you for coming by with your excrement new Brown camera.
Thanks, guys. It was nice to see you again.
What a great interview. It's always good to see the Charles. Ben, where can people find you on the net?
You can look me up on IMDb. My name should be under the Blair Witch Project, and that is where I worked on the film and never got mentioned.
Okay, Ben, that's about all we have time for today. Why don't you sign us off?
Until next time.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast.
Okay, so that was the AI version.
And thank you to AI Charles Papert, who we haven't had on the show in a really long time, but no. is a wonderful, funny guy who also apparently was totally cool with creating the Brown camera.
and punking us that way. And, you know, clearly Charles was in on the joke. He knew about it and kept a secret. I've seen Charles several times, probably since Andy got the idea to do this, and never once let it slip. So
do I complain about the Blair Witch thing that much? Jesus Christ.
I think it's that there was one episode in which you really did complain about it and brought it up two or three times. And then ever since then, now you will be razzed.
That's fair. That's fair. I laughed my ass off when I heard this. I thought it was awesome. And I really feel like the AI nailed you.
Who knew I was so easy to impersonate? Here's the funny
You're
thing.
You're half robot already, Ilya.
I clearly at least half. What's really funny about this is that Andy tells me that it took no more than 5 minutes to complete this. Now, granted, the script, the humor, that's all human. That's Andy. That was not the AI.
That was
the
so
AI
funny.
did not come up with the words that were being spoken, just the sounds of our voices. So thank you, Andy, for that. That was a great bit of humor. And I certainly did not expect that the Brown camera would record log, but what else could it record in?
That was, I think, the best joke in the whole piece. I love that. That was great.
Chef's kiss. Well done, Andy.
All great.
So Ben, since that was our
close focus,
was this, I think it's about time that we get to the interview with Alan Poole.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Alan Poole. He is the executive producer and director of Tokyo Vice, and an incredible luminary career that spans back to the early 80s. We're going to talk a little bit about some of your other stuff as well, but I kind of want to dive in immediately to Tokyo Vice because it was one of my favorite shows on HBO, HBO Max, of the last couple of years. Can you give our audience, for the people who've been under a rock, who don't know anything about Tokyo Vice, what is the show? What's the log line or the elevator pitch? How would you describe it?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words, Ilya. I would say Tokyo Vice is a show about an American journalist in Tokyo, Japan, in the late 90s and early 2000s, who was the first non-Japanese person to be able to pass the notoriously difficult entrance exam for the Japanese daily newspapers and get a job as a crime reporter reporting entirely in Japanese. And it's based on a memoir by Jake Adelstein, which is the name of the lead character. We have heavily fictionalized the memoir, but it talks about his adventures as a fledgling crime reporter, discovering everything that lies beneath the tip of the iceberg in the Japanese subcultures of the police, the Yakuza, organized crime, the world of journalism, and of Tokyo's notorious nightlife, also known as the Mizushobai, featuring host clubs, hostess clubs, and many other institutions that we don't share.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And I first became aware of Jake Adelstein from his Twitter account back in like 2007. He used to post all kinds of great stuff. And
he still does. Yeah.
He still does. And I did not make the connection at all until I started watching the very first episode that Tokyo Vice might have this sort of like in reality connection to Miami Vice through Michael Mann, because I saw that Michael Mann directs like the pilot episode. I was not have in my head made the connection Tokyo Vice, Miami Vice. How does Michael Mann come to this?
Well, this was the subject of some discussion because Jake named his memoir Tokyo Vice as a kind of wink and a nod to Michael, the Miami Vice aesthetic, as a way of establishing that he wanted to spin a cool noir narrative about himself. And it was a catchy title, and it helped the book become a bestseller. Cut to many years later, when we were planning the show and when we were looking for a powerful director to set the look and the tone in the pilot, and Michael really wanted to do it, and we were lucky enough to land him. But there's no relationship in the conception of the show whatsoever between Tokyo Vice and Miami Vice. We just happened to hire the filmmaker Michael Mann to make the pilot based on this book that was already called Tokyo Vice. So there was actually a flurry of panic and a number of discussions where we thought, well, if we hire Michael, we should change the name of the show. Because if we call the show Tokyo Vice and Michael directs the pilot, everybody will assume it's a spinoff of Miami Vice. We don't want that. We don't want that mindset out there. We should change the name of the show. And then we realized that was a dead end because it's still going to be based on the memoir Tokyo Vice. And so we just bit the bullet and said, well, we're not going to run a disclaimer saying no relationship. People will obviously bring it up. I'll have to repeat this story over and over again till the end of my days. And then we proceeded with the show that we wanted to make.
And it's really, really a wonderful show. I hope that you're really proud of this one. This is, it's filled with intrigue. The Jake Adelstein character in the show is this muckraking journalist who really kind of fearless and many times diving into the you know, the Japanese underworld of crime and nightlife and all kinds of stuff. And really, there's a warm sort of like honorable heart sort of story that kind of goes through this. And Ken Watanabe plays this fantastic, extremely uncorruptible detective who keeps, you know, I want to say the moral compass of the whole show, because it kind of it takes these twists and turns. What attracted you to this in the beginning? I mean, there's so much good stuff going on in here. I feel like it's easy to see, you know, the story is so attractive, but how did you get involved? How did you come to this? Well,
I'm extremely proud of this show on both a professional and a personal level. The truth is my entire academic background and the start of my filmmaking career was all in Japan. I got my college degree in Japanese literature. I was an expert on Japanese cinema and theater, plying my trade that way as more of a film egghead than a filmmaker. I was drafted in 1984 by Paul Schrader to go to Tokyo with him and make his seminal film Mishima. And that's how I became a filmmaker. And then I did Black Rain. I was very young. I was associate producer, but I did Black Rain with Ridley Scott and Stanley Jaffe, Shirley Lansing, Michael Douglas. And
I saw that in the theater.
It was very, very difficult shoot. And yeah. I said, I was being positioned to be the Japan guy. Mm. I didn't want to be the Japan guy in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So after Black Rain, I didn't sever my connection personally, but I kind of closed the door professionally and said no more Japan-based projects. And then just charted my own course as a producer over the course of 25 years. So I was aware of Tokyo Vice because, of course, I had read Jake's book when it came out. Mm. I'd known J.T. Rogers, the creator and showrunner, for many years. We had tried to work together before on something entirely different. I was following, as a friend of the family, the project over the course of nearly a decade when the producer, John Lesher, who's also one of our executive producers on the show, was trying to set it up as a feature with JT writing, and that didn't work. But there wasn't any particular role for me to play on the feature version of it, except as a booster and emotional supporter and friend. Then when Fifth Season, there was the studio then called Endeavor Content, became involved and refashioned it as an ongoing drama series, suddenly the show became real. There wasn't anybody in the inner circle who really had episodic television experience, and there wasn't anybody in the inner circle who really knew Japanese language or had filmmaking experience in Japan. And so my friends at the studio, I was just then completing another show for them, a show called The Eddie that I developed with Damien Chazelle and that we shot entirely in Paris. The studio said, would you like to come over and do Tokyo Vice with us? And I was like, I mean, that was probably the best timed request I've ever had in my many years in the business. And I said I certainly would. And since these were all already my friends, it was a very easy fit. And that's when I came on board. But I really was, of the principal producers, I really was the last one to come on board. But it represented the kind of full circle closure / homecoming, call it what you will, that doesn't happen very often in one's career. And so it ended up becoming an extraordinarily fulfilling experience for me.
Yeah, there is so much to unpack there, and we're gonna get into some of that. But it's all right. But sticking into Tokyo Vice here for a moment, so you get the call. It's kind of late in the process. Do I understand correctly? This is a pandemic production too. This is being produced, you know, in Tokyo, 2020, 2021, something like that. So the world has completely changed. Do I have that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, basically there were two. My first location scouting trip to Tokyo was the fall of 2019 with Michael. And then we started prepping in the new year, 2020, and we started shooting in March of 2020, when the pandemic had progressed much farther here in the States than it had in Tokyo. In Tokyo, there were precautions, of course, but it was nothing like, it wasn't wreaking the devastation that was wreaking in the States. So we were kind of sequestered and had a rather naive point of view towards it. But we shot 6 days We shot 6 days of the pilot, and we were shut down. We were shut down by, you know, the HBO Max headquarters, and I came home. And only when I came back to LA did I realize the extent to which the country had already been devastated. And we were down for 7 months.
Wow.
Okay. So we came home. I think it was like on March 14th. We shut down, and we didn't go back to Japan until October. So most of 2020, which was peak pandemic, we were all sequestered here, and the entire production was on hold. And then we went back and started shooting again in November, and completed the pilot. And then after the new year into 2021, we launched into episodes 2 through 8 of the first season. But at that point, Japan was much more shut down than the U.S. The U.S. has already started to open up. Mm-hmm. But in Japan, we had extraordinarily stringent procedures and protocols. We did PCR tests every single day. Tokyo was basically shut down. Restaurants had to take last orders at 7 and be closed by 8 p.m. Bars were not open at all. The famous neon of Tokyo was being shut down by 9 p.m. So any kind of second unit shots of the neon soaked streets we had to get like really early in the evening. And it was very difficult to shoot under those circumstances. So we actually did shoot the whole first season under pandemic conditions.
Oh, interesting. Actually
also impacts the I was just going to say, just in terms of cinematography, was that we had the pilot crew had been grandfathered in with visas, and we were using two rotating DPs, ADs, you know, for the two different teams of directors, and half of them had already been hired and grandfathered in for the episodes 2 and 3. But then for episodes 4 and 5, the alternating team, we were not able to get visas for anybody. Nobody could come into Japan. There were no new visas being issued. Even family members could not get in. So all of us who were there, we had to be separated from our families for the entire first season shoot, which resulted in our not being able to hire the DP that we wanted for the B blocks of the show. And we had to bring in a Japanese cinematographer and all Japanese ADs. And it was, it made it a challenging experience. We were fortunate enough to get Jimmy Yanagijima, one of the legendary DPs in Japanese film history, who shot most of Takeshi Kitano's greatest films, as well as Battle Royale. But it did change the nature of the shoot because of our adaptations to the pandemic.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask specifically about the cinematography here too, because I noticed certainly in the pilot episode, and it seems like it kind of carries through, you know, this look through much of the first season in particular. Lots of close-ups, lots of long lenses and close-ups, and I was wondering if that might be because quite often you were trying really not to show the world. Like, you know, it is sort of isolating for Jake to kind of set him apart from everything else. But I was wondering if there was a real effort to try not to give too much information for the background, because it was either the pandemic or things were going on, and you wanted to stay close on Jake and the world. Was there some conscious discussions or talking about the use of long lenses and really, really, you know, close-ups for much of the show?
Not really. I mean, okay. If you look across season one,
yeah.
Remember, across season one, we actually had 4 DPs at one point or another, because the pilot was begun by Diego Garcia, but then was completed by John Grillo after the pandemic shutdown. And then in our 2 rotating spots, then we had Diego come back to work. And then we also had Jimmy Yanagijima, who was the Japanese DP we had to hire because we couldn't get an American in. But then Diego had to leave midway through the season. And suddenly we had to bring in a new DP. We couldn't bring anybody in. We couldn't find anybody else Japanese who was appropriate. So Daniel Fatinoff, who was our DIT at that point, we elevated him to DP
for
episodes 6 and 7. And that was a kind of an amazing opportunity, a huge gamble on our part, and also on the part of HBO Max, who very graciously went along with us. And then Daniel was elevated to DP, and then Daniel carried through continuing on season 2. So each of those candidates brought their own elements to the look of the show. But I would say that Michael was fonder of the long lenses, whereas once we got certainly Joseph Latika working with Diego in episodes 2 and 3, there was a lot more. I mean, the 65 was sort of like the long lens, but we also were using the 40 and 50 a lot more than Michael had. So yeah. I don't think we were trying to hide the world.
Okay.
But I will say that the show is so character centric. Mm-hmm. I think that certainly in terms of the use of close-ups, it was always performance-based, because if you didn't feel like you knew what was going on inside our characters' heads, then all you had was a crime story.
Yeah, Joseph Kubota-Vladika, a good friend of the show, has been on the show before too, and he did some really great work. You also directed some episodes of Tokyo Vice, including the season 2 premiere, which really up like just like right where season 1 sort of leaves off, and it's such a great cliffhanger and such a great sort of like back into that whole into the whole world. Talk a little bit about, you know, the experience of directing versus executive producing, at least as far as you're concerned. How do you bifurcate your brain in those different roles for this sort of work?
Well, I hire the directors basically, and I supervise. And when I am directing, it is always an incredible joy to be able to, at least during those 12 hours on set every day, to try to let go of all the other hats that I have to wear and just wear the hat that causes me to focus 100% on what is taking place in front of the camera. And that's exhilarating, sometimes scary, liberating, and the best job in the world as far as I'm concerned. In terms of starting off season 2, it was a very unusual situation because Daniel Satinoff, who had, you know, stepped up and completed season 1, was coming back, of course, but he had formed a close bond with Joseph, and he wanted to work with Joseph, and Joseph wanted to work with him. But they were not doing the first block of episodes. They were starting with episode 3, and I was directing episodes 1 and 2. I always choose either the first episodes or the last episodes because it's one less arena that's active that allows me to focus on directing. If I'm doing the last episode, then nobody's prepping. I don't have to oversee a prepping director. If I'm doing episodes 1 and 2, then nobody's shooting when I'm prepping. So you know what I mean? It allows me to focus that much more. But that meant I had to start off with our new DP, was going to start off the second season, and Daniel, who brought some sense of continuity, was going to go second, which is not the way you would normally structure things. But I had the incredible good fortune to find Corey Walter. Corey, I think, is a genius. Corey brought, with a great deal of respect for what had been shot before and also constantly in conversation with Daniel, Corey still, I think, managed to expand the visual range of the show that was a big factor in the way season 2 feels so much more opened up to the city. And so much more exploratory of the city, and just on a grander scale. Like we were trying to be very kind of tight and close in season 1 because we had less access to locations, but also to make sure that the story stayed focused. And now that we knew our own identity in season 2, then, you know, it's time to loosen the reins a little bit. If you have in your blood what the show is, you don't have to like set up external restrictions to curtail yourself. So the biggest example of that was the shot that opens the season, which is something that I'm very, very proud of. It was really, we had designed an opening that was entirely different, and Corey and I shot it, and we just knew that it didn't work. And so we started racking our brains. And it started with Corey having the idea of, I have this image of just coming down over Tokyo Bay and finding the boat. And then somehow we'll figure out that it's the boat that Paulina died on at the end of season 1. And then when I heard that and started thinking that, I came up with the idea of, well, we'll come onto the boat and move through the boat, and we'll go down into the boat, and we'll gradually realize we're about to go into the stateroom where she was killed. And the minute they open the door, we'll be back in Katagiri's living room watching the video, which is exactly where we left off at the end of the season. So we can pick up where we left off, but with a great big elaborate tease leading up to it.
That boat is traveling like from left to right across screen for such a long period of time. It's a really, really wonderful shot, and it does kind of draw you in. It's like, what's going on here? And you see all of the sort of action that's taking place. I'm assuming long lens from shore, and that boat really was traveling, or were you traveling? Do you want to give away your secret here? How did you pull that shot off?
I think I've already kind of given it away, at least in parts, but no, that actually, it appears to be a single shot. It's three pieces that are stitched together by Alchemy 24, our VFX shop. And so the first shot where we come down into Tokyo Bay, that's all that was done with a drone. We were sitting on a little boat in the middle of Tokyo Bay. The final shot where we're walking down the corridor and about to go into the room, and we see the two guys come ahead of the camera and go in, that was shot on a set that we built just outside of Tokyo to replicate what the inside of the ship would have looked like. and everything in between, where we come along the side of the boat and go into the boat and move towards the stairs, was done on a boat that was docked in Liberty Park, New Jersey.
Right,
because we couldn't find a yacht in Japan. They don't have a lot of yachts in Japan, to be honest. And so actually that the most complicated piece of the shot is the one that we had to shoot last and make sure that it would fit with the bookends we had already shot. So it was one of the biggest logistical challenges I've ever faced, but I'm glad it paid off.
It totally did. Okay. In the last few minutes we've got here, I want to go way back. I mean, in your career, you've won an Emmy, a Golden Globe, multiple Peabody's, 5 GLAAD Awards, Producers Guild Award. You won a lot of awards, but go back all the way to the college version of you when you're studying Japanese and trying to like figure out, I think, what you're going to do in the world. How do you go from going to school at Yale to ending up working on movies in Japan? I know you were a cinephile. I know you were into Japanese cinema. I'm assuming like Ozu and Kurosawa and of course bigs like that. But tell me how you go from Japanese language and literature to filmmaker. How does that happen?
Well, I was always a stage struck kid growing up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, theater and film. I just, you know, I loved them both equally. I always thought my career would be in theater. I used to write musicals, truth be told. But when I spent my junior year abroad living in Tokyo, studying the language intensively for an entire year. And that was when my Japanese best friend was a cinephile. And I knew, you know, the big Kurosawa, Ichikawa, Ozu Mizoguchi films, but that was it. And he used to take me to these all-night quadruple features that they would have in Shinjuku, because the trains don't run between 1 and 5 a.m. So you have to have somewhere to be until the trains start running again. So we go to these all-night quadruple features, and that's where I discovered the work of Seijun and Suzuki, of Shohei Imamura, of a lot of the great Mikio Naruse, great Japanese master directors who were less known in the West. So I became a little bit of an expert in the golden age of Japanese cinema, which positioned me to get this job curating retrospectives of actors and directors at the Japan Society on East 47th Street, and being able to host all these Japanese directors and actors when they would come and present their films. And so I was kind of like movie adjacent in that way. And it was that specifically that experience that I had, especially knowing Japanese actors so well and knowing Japanese cinema, because I was introduced to Paul Schrader by mutual acquaintances. And he said, drop what you're doing, come to Japan with me for a year. We'll make this movie together. I'll make you the associate producer and you'll have a new career. And I said, okay. And that was it. So it was really just, I was just following my very diverse,
right place, right time,
bifurcated passions. And it happened to make me a filmmaker. So it's all thanks to Schrader, but the pieces fell together in a remarkably synergistic way.
That's phenomenal. You know, everyone's story in this industry is different, and that's a great one. I'm glad that you were able to, you know, go after what you're interested in, and it just happened to unfold in this way. I mean, I know we're out of time, but it was such a delight chatting with you. I'm so glad that you could come on the show. I hope that you'll do it again.
Can I say one final thing as a kind of a postscript? So that story about Schrader, we're talking about full circle moments, you know, Mishima is a film that has never been shown in Japan. It was very controversial. Mishima's own, his widow, very much opposed the filmmaking. And so although, you know, we won a prize at Cannes and the film has been revered around the world and there's a big Criterion Collection Blu-ray DVD out, it has never been projected in Japan. And I just came back from Tokyo last week, and like, it's not a done deal yet, but I can say with some confidence that it looks like at this October's Tokyo International Film Festival, we will be presenting 40 years later the Japanese premiere of Paul Schrader's Mishima.
Congratulations. That's
awesome.
If you wait long enough,
you can make things happen.
Oh, that's really phenomenal. Alan Poole, thank you so much for being on the show. It's really a delight to chat with you. I really hope you'll come back again and talk to us about what you're working on next.
I would love to. I wish we had more time. It's been a pleasure.
All right, so that was Alan Poole. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm crestfallen that there's not a season 3, but you know, that's how it goes. And seasons 1 and 2 are spectacular, that show. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing what happens next.
Excellent, excellent.
And now, Short Ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's the time we talk about our obsessions of the week. What is it that you are obsessed with?
this week?
Well, it's been an interesting month of showbiz documentaries that hit on nostalgia from like our childhood era. And I don't know if we mentioned on the show the documentary that's on Disney Plus called Idea Man about Jim Henson. But
yes.
there are literally three showbiz nostalgia documentaries. Maybe there are more, but three that dropped within the last month. That one, I think, is head and shoulders the best one. Directed by Ron Howard, friend of the show, Ron Howard, guy who I used to work for, Ron Howard. Awesome dude. Then there are two others. And I don't like going negative, but I'm going to go a little negative on one of them. So the first one, which I will not go negative on, is called Remembering Gene Wilder.
And
it is on Max. And it's great. It's a great documentary about Gene Wilder. For those of you who don't know who Gene Wilder is, you probably saw the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, or Blazing Saddles, or Young Frankenstein, or Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask, or any of the many movies he made with Richard Pryor. But Gene Wilder was just a comic genius, an actor, a director, an amazing guy. And that documentary is freaking brilliant. And like I said, I only touched on it briefly, but Idea Man, which is about the Muppets, it's about Jim Henson creating the Muppets, but basically about Jim Henson's whole life using amazing archival footage of Jim Henson. I mean, like, it's rare for a documentary to get me all choked up, but it really does get you choked up and nostalgic. It gives you a weird hit of nostalgia for a kind of entertainment that it's not that we don't have puppets anymore, but honestly, any puppet you see in something is derivative of a Jim Henson puppet, and just the way he worked and the kind of stuff he did and the output of amazing work that came out of him. Which leads me to the third entertainment nostalgia documentary called Bratz. I was born to love this documentary, and I am sad to report that I do not. It is
is it about the dolls?
No, it's about the Brat Pack.
Ah, okay, got it. Okay.
And it's directed by Andrew McCarthy. And so, Ilya, you're a little younger than me, but we're roughly the same age, and I assume
by
you grew
2 years.
You grew up with the Brat Pack similarly.
Sure.
So, who would you say are core Brat Pack? Who's the Brat Pack?
Oh man. Well, I mean, Emilio Estevez maybe?
He was definitely sort of like he's interviewed in this, although it looks like a hostage situation, but he is interviewed.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay. I would say probably half the Breakfast Club at least. So Molly Ringwald, maybe?
Not interviewed.
Okay.
Anthony Michael Hall, not Anthony Michael mentioned. Hall? His name is not mentioned out loud.
Oh, dear. Okay.
They do interview Ali Sheedy.
James Spader?
They do not interview James Spader. They don't really talk very much about James Spader or John Cusack or Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
Or I could go on and on. They do interview John Cryer, who I would say is Brat Packish. He was in one Brat Pack movie.
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
Really only one movie. But like Anthony Michael Hall was in like three or four John Hughes movies. Like that's to me.
Sure.
John Hughes is Brat Pack ground zero.
Exactly.
They do interview Rob Lowe, and I'm like, Rob Lowe was in St. Elmo's Fire, which is a Brat Pack movie. But it's about the Brat Pack being all grown up. It's not the same. I found the movie to be so completely up its own butt. Andrew McCarthy basically is like making a documentary about how all of the people who were like rich and famous off of being Brat Pack got upset when the label Brat Pack landed on them and how they fought against that label. Judd Nelson, not interviewed. Talked about a lot, but not interviewed. It's like, I don't mean to be like this, but I barely would have considered Andrew McCarthy Brat Pack. He was in St. Elmo's Fire, and he was in Class, and he was in a couple of other movies around that time, but I never really thought of him as like core Brat Pack. And he's our director, but he's also like on camera a lot, a whole lot. And the movie sort of feels to me like an apology for why his career kind of didn't continue into the 90s and the 2000s. I mean, if you look him up on IMDb, he's kept working. He's okay. I'm not too worried about Andrew McCarthy. But,
he's going to be okay.
But it's like, I grew up, I mean, like, I was one of those kids who would sit at a party with all my 12-year-old friends, and we would put in a VHS tape of The Breakfast Club, and every one of us knew every line of that movie.
No, no, it wasn't the Breakfast Club. It was Weekend at Bernie's. It was Weekend at Bernie's. It was Andrew McCarthy, Weekend at Bernie's. That it was, wasn't it?
I'm not slagging on Weekend at Bernie's. No, but like we all knew the Breakfast Club. We all knew 16 Candles. Now, we all knew Weird Science. Now, some of these movies have aged better than others.
Sure. Robert Downey Jr. gets included in that too. He was in Weird Science. I mean,
Robert Downey Jr., not mentioned. Charlie Sheen, not mentioned.
Charlie Sheen, like, you know, it's kind of like the other half of Emilio Estevez at that time. Kiefer Sutherland, not ever
mentioned. And Kiefer Sutherland wasn't in any of the John Hughes movies, but he was like in Young Guns. So,
The Lost Boys. Anyway.
It was a very frustrating documentary because, like, when I saw that there was a documentary about the Brat Pack, it was one of those moments of, like, God damn it, I wish I'd thought to make a documentary about the Brat Pack. I think it's a really interesting kind of cultural moment that you and I lived through that someone who's under 40 probably is not going to realize kind of the cultural impact of that. And moreover, sort of the more recent cultural reappraisal of especially the John Hughes movies and sort of the transgressive things they did that were maybe not so good, not so wonderful.
Yeah, not all John Hughes movies date quite as well as others. So,
and they talk about John Hughes in the documentary. They talk about him a good bit, and they actually address a little bit of that, like how John Hughes never really cast people of color in any of his movies. And I was like, yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. The only person of color I can think of was in 16 Candles, and it was kind of an Asian ridiculous stereotype.
Yeah, not a particularly flattering. Not a particularly flattering character.
But yeah. Anyway, I would say that, like, if I was to, I wanted to talk about all three of these at the same time, because I feel like the thing about Idea Man is that Idea Man is like, because Ron Howard is the one making it, it's a real film. I mean, it's a documentary with lots of interviews. It's interviews, it's B-roll. It's what you expect, but it's so artfully done. So brilliantly done because Ron Howard really is just like,
Ron Howard's Ron Howard. Yeah. It's like, you know, yeah, he doesn't phone it in ever.
He's freaking brilliant. And then Remembering Gene Wilder is kind of more what you expect. It's a pretty straightforward documentary. It's like loaded with amazing footage. And if you haven't ever seen a Gene Wilder movie, I think if you watch that documentary, you would still walk away blown away by what Gene Wilder was able to do and in his amazing career. And I didn't realize, like, there were some things I didn't know about it. Like, I had no idea that he had that he suffered from Alzheimer's towards the end.
I didn't know about any
of that. But, you know, they have extensive interviews with Mel Brooks. They have extensive interviews with his, you know, his wife. They talk a lot about Gilda Radner. It's kind of a slice of comedy from the late 60s through the end of the 80s, I would say. Yeah. So if I were to recommend these in order, I'd say start with Idea Man, then definitely watch Remembering Gene Wilder, and then Bratz, you might want to sit that one out or have relatively low expectations, unless you're an Andrew McCarthy completist, in which case it's just pornography for you.
I rather like the Jim Henson documentary. And yes, you're right. It's pretty rich in nostalgia. It's very nostalgic.
But it's great. I mean, it's absolutely great. And the kind of footage that they have of the Muppets, but also, like, probably a lot of us haven't seen the behind the scenes of the Muppet stuff. And, you know, honestly, just having all the extensive interviews with Frank Oz, for that alone, it's worth it. But it's just so well done. And Ron Howard is just such a bright light of filmmaking. It's interesting to see sort of at this point in his career where he's kind of alternating now. He'll do a documentary, he'll do a narrative film, he'll do a doc. And I feel like if we ever get him on the show again, I'll ask him about this. But it's like, I feel like it's infusing both sides of it, because the documentary side definitely has kind of the touch of a narrative filmmaker in it. In that he maybe does stuff that someone who's just a documentarian might not occur to them to do. Like, he did some cool, like, stop motion-y things and stuff that sort of felt in character with the film.
I agree. It's really, really well put together. Yeah.
But skip Bratz. Anyway, Ilya, so I've been watching a bunch of entertainment documentaries. What productive thing have you been doing over the last week?
All right. You know, we had Alan Poole on this episode as our featured guest. I mentioned sort of right after the interview that, you know, no season 3. I'm really disappointed about season three, and it turns out the internet's pretty disappointed about it too, because even like big mainstream publications like Forbes was really sort of like teasing like, hey, looks like there's a good chance there'll be a season three of Tokyo Vice. I want to say that multiple places, including also Jake Adelstein, Jake Adelstein, sort of the original writer of Tokyo Vice, of the book that was optioned and turned into this, he was sort of like teasing, hey, I got a new book, be great, you know, fertile ground for a season three. And I think that there was just enough people out there that sort of had their hopes up that there was more coming. But from Variety and from Hollywood Reporter and from various other interviews, HBO Max decided not to do more Tokyo Vice. So
I think you mean Max.
I do mean Max. And I think that maybe we have to say it in this sort of like Darth Vader Max voice from Max. Here on out. But who knows? Maybe if it does do well at the Emmys, maybe someone else will pick it up. Maybe someone else. I mean, there's such fertile ground. There's people speculating about spinoffs, all kinds of things that they could do from that.
So would the spinoffs be like more rural communities in Japan, the Vice Squad in Osaka or something?
I don't know. It doesn't look like it's going to happen. But so I'll get off of my soapbox and my rant about another great show seemingly, you know, cast off into the wilderness the same way that Winning Time was. Winning Time was another one of these shows that I think it was really expensive to produce. And I was think that maybe Zaslav and company wanted cheap shows that was going to keep people tuning in. But man, I want good shows. I want shows that make me pay attention. I want shows that, you know, have a lot going on. And I've come to expect that from HBO. I've come to expect that from, you know, premier programming at Max. But it's... Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I would say expect more of less, because there's just a lot less stuff that's going to get made. You know, the industry is kind of not in a great way right now. You know, a lot of people out of work.
That is true. And I didn't look at the box office for this weekend. I don't know if Inside Out 2 was number one.
Oh, but with a bullet. I mean, like it set records. It was, I think worldwide it made like 140 million.
It deserved to. I was one of the people who went out and saw it. I took my pubescent kids to go see it, which is, let me tell you, anyone in the sound of my voice, if you've got, you know, kids in puberty, go see Inside Out 2. It's a great movie for them. It's a great movie for everybody. Absolutely worth watching, 100%. And I was going to say, to me, it felt like that's the start of summer. To me, that felt like the start of summer sort of movie season. And
I would say Bad Boys, the fourth Bad Boys was probably the real start, you know. But those two, between the two of them, are like the two big hits of the summer so far.
Well, I didn't see Bad Boys 1 through 3, so.
That's fair.
So, yeah, it wasn't exactly on my radar, but, you know, I think
you could probably see the Bad Boys 4 without having seen 1 through 3. I think you just kind of go with it.
I saw, like, Fast and Furious 1 through 6. I don't think I need to see another one. I think I've seen
everything. But I think if you just wanted to jump into Fast 6 and you don't want to watch 1 through 5, you're okay. No, you can kind of put it together. I heard Inside Out 2 was great. I haven't seen it yet. I was working over the weekend, but my wife took my son to go see it, and they loved it.
Mm-hmm. All right, cool.
And it's good to hear that. I mean, okay, but between Bad Boys 4 and Inside Out 2, it's actually the best thing that's happened all summer is that people, when properly incentivized, will go to the movie theater, because I was scratching my head about all the big movies that just tanked at the beginning of the summer, including Furiosa, which I thought was pretty awesome, but everything was just one after another was tanking. And so Bad Boys 4 and Inside Out 2, even though they're both sequels, they both showed that if you give people a reason to go to the theater, whatever that reason is, they'll actually do it.
So Ben, where can people find you if they want to catch up with you outside of this show?
Well, you should go to benrock.com.
Does it mention the Blair Witch Project?
No, not at all. No, I've scrubbed the Blair Witch Project completely off of my website, and I dare anyone to prove otherwise. Go to benrock.com, and I dare you to find a single mention of the Blair Witch Project.
All right.
How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Most days you can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, either in Los Angeles or Portland, Oregon, opening soon. So, Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible?
As always, Alana Cody, who's setting up all the interviews, and you're doing all the interviews. Remember back in the day when we would do an interview and you would just kind of be in the room with a laptop in case we needed to look something up and to kind of...
That's true.
Now you're like doing more than half of them. You're kicking ass.
holy crap, I think I did like four in the last week or so. It's been a lot.
And you owe all of that to Alana Cody, our producer, who never stops. Like, she's always getting, lining stuff up and checking in. And
Energizer Bunny of producers, let me tell you.
She's the best. This podcast would not be going week to week the way it has for, like, what, 6 years now, if it had not been for her.
Oh, shit. Here's another, you know, bomb I'll just drop. Like, day before yesterday, we hit 2 million downloads.
Whoa! So,
I know. Didn't we only hit, like, a million, like, a year and a half ago or something like that? So we had, like, 8 years to get to a million, and then now it's been a couple of years, and now we're at 2 million. So,
wow.
Crazy. So I know.
We're algorithmic.
Something like that.
There's some kind of mathy thing that I could say here that would be witty. If my friend Rebecca Larson were here, she would tell me exactly the one to use.
Exponential.
There you go. Exponential. Yeah. So, yeah, we should thank. So, in summary, thanking Alana Cody. And then we should also thank Ben Katz, our intrepid editor, who just got over COVID.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. So feel bad for
it's still anyone out there. I know it's really bad. So
there's like a whole new strain that's just cutting through the population right now. And then last but never least, we should thank Kay Zalatrakshi, who composed every scrap of music that you heard on this episode. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Email him, bug him, troll him.
I believe he is COVID free. So, you know,
100% COVID free, as far as I can tell. Yeah, I actually saw him like twice last week. So that was, you know, a post parenthood record of seeing anyone twice in 1 week.
Well done.
All right. So, Ilya, you want to take us out the way you like to do it with the words that you say when you do the taking out?
You know what? I think that we've missed an opportunity and I'm going to change that right now. That's a wrap. That's a wrap. We should be saying that's a wrap at the end of this show.
So. Holy crap.
That's a wrap.
It was right there the whole time.
It's right there the whole time. Never said it. Not once. And it's the type of thing that, like, you look forward to hearing it when you're on set. It's like, I get to go home now. Get to take a shower. Get to, like, wash this, like, day of work off of me. And it's right here. That's a wrap.
Hey, can I tell a tale out of school? This is almost a war story. Not quite.
Oh, this is great. This is the best ending to an episode we've ever had. It goes on.
This is the shaggiest shaggy dog ever.
Woo! All right.
I once worked with a DP. I'm not going to say who it was for reasons that will become obvious very soon. Mm. But on the first day of shooting, the AD said to me, because you sit around talking about movies on sets all the time, the AD said,
Go ask the DP.
Go ask the DP what his favorite shot of all time is. And I was like, sounds like you're hazing me, so I'm not going to do it. So I was there second or third day. I finally went up to the DP and I said, what was your favorite shot of all time? And he goes, oh, yeah. My favorite shot of all time is the last one we do today, because when we're done with that, I get to go home.
Yep. That is a sufficiently crusty DP who's been around the block once or twice.
Wasn't even that old.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't take much in this industry to really to become that guy.
And can I say, by the way, if by any chance anyone who knows him or if he himself is listening.
Now you've outed his gender.
I outed his gender, so now everyone knows it's a male DP. So,
There's only like three in this industry.
That's true. So. if he happens to hear this or someone who knows him is able to put this together, I just want to say his work is exquisite and I loved working with him. But I don't think he liked working on that show. So that's a wrap.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.